Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the week in review, starting with a week of controversy surrounding changes to the insurance offered to state and municipal employees.
Our members are pissed about this decision.
We'll talk about that and the state of the Commonwealth and more in the Week in Review. Also today, Boston Public Schools are under fire over concerns that they may have shared information about students with federal immigration authorities.
We've been concerned for some time now about what we're starting to realize is a school to deportation pipeline.
And the three finalists for Massachusetts K-12 Ed Commissioner, they're facing intense public interviews today. What are their visions for the state's public schools? Plus, Emerson professor Jabari Asim on his new children's book about African-American history. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, Week in Review time, and we'll start with the uproar over big proposed changes to health insurance for Massachusetts state workers.
They deserve to have the freedom to choose the health plans that is best for themselves and their families, not have it dictated to them.
That was James O'Brien of the Boston Carmen's Union berating the Group Insurance Commission for its decision to limit health plan options for hundreds of thousands of state employees. The backlash was intense, so Governor Charlie Baker chimed in.
I've made clear to the GIC that they need to sit down and talk as quickly as possible with the affected parties that are involved in this. Because there's a tremendous amount of confusion out there.
Then Attorney General Maura Healey opened an investigation into the GIC's decision, saying the commission may have violated state open meeting laws. So yesterday, Dr. Roberta Herman, executive director of the GIC, tried to defuse the situation.
We're recommending for the February 1st meeting that there be a motion to reconsider the recent vote, which resulted in consolidating the insurance carriers.
Translation, we're going to control-Z this entire mess, undo the decision, and bring all the insurance plans back. So I wonder what our Week in Review panel makes of it all. Let me have them tell us. Joining us is Tom Keene. He's a former Boston City Councilor and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. And also, he contributes to The Globe as well. Tom, it's good to see you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I know you're jumping out of your chair to talk about the GIC.
Health insurance is so exciting.
Exciting and important, okay? But also with us this week is Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston. She's also a columnist for the Boston Globe and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti page. It's great to see you again, Renee.
Thank you so much.
And you share Tom's excitement to talk about this. But let's do it anyway. I'm going to force you guys to do this. I have to say my first reaction, yes, that there's a lot of sort of policy sausage-making things going on here, which may or may not be of interest to people. But this was a decision that the GIC took that did have an effect on hundreds of thousands of state employees. And it seemed like it was just ham-fisted, to say the least. So, Renee, your thoughts?
Well, I think the quick turnaround on this, which, you know, really was quite devastating in a way, is indication, if we need anything further, that it's an election year. Okay.
Yeah.
Governor Baker did say that this process was flawed and he wanted to revisit it, but it was his own administration and finance secretary who sits on the GIC board who voted for this these cuts. And the woman who is the commissioner, Rebecca Herman, we just heard.
Roberta Herman, yeah.
Herman, whom we just heard, is another, you know, Baker acolyte. She had the position that he had previously at Harvard Pilgrim. So these are his people who are making this decision. I think he's just very aware of the power of unions. It's surprising to me, you know, he's not really a, you know, warm and fuzzy union guy, but I think he is cognizant of their their clout in an election year.
Yeah. So I'm not quibbling with any of your points here, but just to clarify some facts, Charlie Baker was CEO at Harvard Pilgrim, and
yes.
Roberta Herman was chief operating officer there and chief medical officer.
COO,
but
yes.
their time did overlap,
yes.
Indeed, at Harvard Pilgrim. And interestingly, Harvard Pilgrim was one of the plans that the GIC was going to step away from with the idea to save $20 million from the state. So that's also a big part, more than $20 million, actually. That's a part of the story in terms of at least the reasoning of why they wanted to make this decision, Tom.
It is. And I'm going to be a little bit of a cynic here, okay? It was hundreds of thousands of state employees who were affected. It was also hundreds of thousands of customers of big companies that are losing those customers, and they're really upset about it.
Well, they were saying they were going to have to fire people.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so what you are seeing here is a huge pushback from the companies who are able this time to really ally themselves with the workers at the same time. I think that double barrel thing coming to Charlie Baker is why you now see the GIC reversing itself.
Okay. So let me ask you to elaborate on the point that you were making, Renee, about Governor Baker himself. I mean, we heard him react pretty quickly and say the GIC has got to clarify what's going on. But, you know, Tom, just respond to Renee's point. He appointed several of these people on the commission, and yet I feel like I'm going to be fair here. I mean, you can't hold the governor responsible for all the decisions that his appointees make. But on the other hand, every time this happens, Baker seems to just stand there and say, you guys fix it. And he's like Teflon.
Right. And this is a good politician is like Teflon, right? A good politician sort of sets the parameters, lets something float as a trial balloon or as some proposal, sees what happens. If it's good, takes credit for it. If it's bad, says, I can't believe you guys did this.
Yeah. Renee, your thoughts?
I don't know. It's hard to say about Charlie Baker that he's a disengaged or disinterested governor. I mean, he gets
I wouldn't say that
right?
at all.
He gets down into the weeds of policy, especially regarding health care. This is his area of expertise. And I suspect that he has, I don't know this, but I suspect that he has indicated an interest in controlling costs, health care costs, however possible. And, you know, the GIC commissioners were kind of marching to his tune there.
Yeah, I have no doubt that he knew about it. I mean, I can't believe that they would have gotten rid of Harvard Pilgrim without telling the former CEO of Harvard Pilgrim that was happening. I'm sure he knew about it. And he was going to see what happened in terms of the blowback, and the blowback was much more than they thought.
Yeah. So this brings me to the sort of maybe nuts and bolts of the state open meeting law, because I have to say, when Attorney General Maura Healey said she's going to take a look at this, and that got us everyone to look back at, for example, the announcement for the agenda on the day of the meeting where they made this decision. It really is spectacularly vague, right? They just talk about procurement, you know, Medicare versus commercial/vote. That's like all that's written there. I don't know. I have to admit, I'm not spending a lot of time looking at agendas for the GIC, so I don't know if this is part and parcel in how they do it. But you got to wonder if they knew that this was going to be a big deal and didn't necessarily want to attract a lot of attention to
it. Yeah, I'm assuming they think this is an exception under employee benefits and compensation, and that somehow maybe they were able to get that through. They didn't need to do it. But I agree with you. If it's not under that exemption, you would think it would have been better publicized.
Yeah. I mean, we're just living in a time right now where transparency is really paramount.
Yeah.
And I think in all walks of life, and especially of public life. And I think even if this was sort of standard operating procedure for these kinds of agendas, that the GIC and all government agencies ought to, you know, be a little bit more careful about how closed door their proceedings are.
Yeah.
There's one other thing I'd point out here, and that is by doing this, you save $23 million by switching over to other providers. Mm. Arguably, they're saying delivering the same health care. So maybe this is a little bit of a push on the healthcare providers to say, we need you to bring your rates down.
I'm glad you brought that up, because they were saying that they needed to keep the increase in rates below 5%. You know, they're trying to somehow force healthcare spending, at least for these state employees, to come in line closer to inflation. I mean, it's a huge problem that we all have to grapple with. And, you know, maybe this was the thing to get their attention, but ultimately, in the end, the way it was executed, it's not going to pan out.
Well, I will see. I actually think you may see Harvard Pilgrim and the others come down a bit in exchange for allowing them to stay.
Your thoughts, Renee?
Well, I mean, I think the large number of state employees and retirees, especially, and, you know, pensioners and so on, who once worked for the state, are a big drag on our healthcare costs. But when there have been other efforts to try to get the state employees to kitch in a little bit more, you know, maybe a little bit more of their percentage, you know, they would take on more of the healthcare costs of that benefit, there was a long process and a lot of discussion and months of negotiations that were quite public. So I think a lot of what's going on here is the slap in the face of not being informed or considered.
Yeah, back to that importance of transparency.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's shift gears here and talk about the state of the Commonwealth more broadly, because this week, Governor Charlie Baker gave his fourth State of the Commonwealth address, and he came out and said it. The state of the Commonwealth is strong, so let's listen.
In 2017, we had more people working than at any time in state history. Our economy has added 180,000 new jobs since we took office, and best of all, the number of people looking for work has dropped in every county over the past 3 years, and in most cases, by more than 35%.
Renee Loth, your thoughts?
You know, I noticed that Bill Weld was at the State House for this address. You know, he's Charlie Baker's sort of political mentor. And it made me think about the qualities that people loved about Bill Weld that Charlie Baker shares and some that he does not share. Mm. The ones that he shares is this sort of casual, kind of no drama, even phlegmatic attitude that Weld had and that Charlie Baker also has. And I think that people respond to. What he doesn't share is Weld's laziness. Here's a guy, this guy, our governor, is really a hard worker, and he does get into those gritty, nitty details about LED streetlights and
trees
and vocational education, blah. And I think people really do appreciate that. You know, we had some, quite uplifting vision and rhetoric from the previous governor, Governor Patrick. And this is kind of, in a way, a palate cleanser for people. I think he's extremely popular. And it was clear at this, this address, which was given to a overwhelmingly Democratic audience.
Right.
And people were standing up every couple of minutes.
Elected Democrats. I'm going to underscore that. We're falling all over themselves to congratulate the governor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If I were Jay Gonzalez or Seti Warren, I would not have been happy about the response of that. I would also notice, by the way, in terms of the incredible economy, I couldn't believe he didn't give credit to Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In fact, what was really interesting is that the word Republican and the acknowledgement that he might be a Republican never occurred in that entire address.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
Yeah. I mean, I actually thought that, beyond all of those granular details about the wonky, state government, the thing that really moved me was about 20 minutes into the speech where he said something like, we want our people to live good lives and have opportunity and so on, but we want people to believe in their government.
Exactly.
And I thought, that is such a simple statement. And yet in these times, these like ghastly political times, this coming from a Republican in particular, it's profound. And so that was what, stayed with me after the address was over.
I don't know what to think about that, because on the one hand, that stayed with me. Just sort of the plain, simple call towards having functioning government, right? Bipartisan functioning government. The fact that seems like soaring rhetoric today.
Yeah.
I mean, it made me feel more depressed than anything else.
It's interesting within the Republican Party, there are sort of two groups. There's, I think, now the larger group that really doesn't believe in government. It's almost libertarian. It really wishes government.
You're speaking nationally.
Nationally. Yeah. Mm. And Charlie Baker clearly is part of a very different group. I mean, it may have more conservative approaches to policy, but it fundamentally and at its core really does believe in government. And that's been Baker's life. His life has been in government for the most part. He was ANF secretary. He really loves this kind of stuff. And as Renee said, he gets into the nitty-gritty. This is a man who does want government to work. And maybe that's what's refreshing. It's not the rhetoric that's refreshing, but simply the fact that you have someone who is a more conservative Republican who actually is saying the government matters.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the places where he does receive some pushback, primarily from the three Democrats who are running against him. I want to play a little bit from the portion of the State of the Commonwealth address where the governor, Governor Baker, spoke about education.
We have the highest four-year graduation rate and the lowest dropout rate we've ever had. To continue that momentum, we're funding K-12 education at the highest level in history, more than $4.7 billion. And tomorrow's budget submission will boost that number by another $100 million representing an increase of nearly $500 million since we took office.
So it sounds great, but there are some pushback from state Senate Democrats who say when you take into account inflation, it's pretty much level funded and not perhaps as impressive as the governor's numbers make it sound. Here's what one of Charlie Baker's Democratic challengers, former Newton Mayor Seti Warren, told WBUR after the speech.
Governor Baker continues to say no new revenue. And here we have critical issue of education. We have students taking on huge student debt at the state and community college system. We need additional resources. Massachusetts has the worst commuter rail system in the country. We haven't made investments in the infrastructure. It's clear.
So that's Seti Warren there, Renee, saying, yeah, things look great on the surface, but when it comes to actual investment, it sounds like he's saying he's not as impressed.
Well, you know, you always put the state of the state address in the best possible light for yourself, especially in an election year. So, of course, the governor focused on the spending and investments that will be made in the budget that he just submitted this week. But you do have to wonder that Massachusetts is, as he said, as Baker said, you know, hitting on all cylinders in terms of the economy. You know, our unemployment is practically full employment. You know, we're consistently rated at the top of various indices about, you know, economic development and creativity and innovation and all this kind of thing. And if we can't be investing more significantly in these key areas, infrastructure, education, and so on, healthcare, now, we'd never be able to. So you have to wonder why at this particular moment there isn't more of the political capital and even the actual dollar capital being spent.
Huh, interesting. As a complete aside, you remember the section of a speech where he talked about all the different metrics by which Massachusetts is doing well?
Yeah.
Just I thought that it was an impressive list, but then he threw in some survey from Thumbtack.
And Thumbtack? I didn't even know what that was.
Oh, it's an online site where you can like hire a contractor or someone to help you out with small jobs. And I don't know the Thumbtack's methodology, but according to them, we're also doing great in terms of small business climate. Tom, your thoughts?
Well, I get that, of course, if you're running against Charlie Baker, you're going to look for the critique. I think, though, you know, from Renee's point of view, and the state is doing really well. And at its core, that's going to be what voters are going to focus upon.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's always things you could do more. But listen to what Seti Warren was saying, which is that he wants to do more spending. And in order to do that, he has to increase revenues. We're going to see that debate joined over the next several months as we actually have a nominee from the Democrats face off against Charlie Baker. And we'll really see how people are going to react to a call for new taxes. I would be wary about that.
We also have significantly the ballot question, assuming that it meets, it beats its challenge, current legal challenge, in the ballot question for a so-called millionaire's tax, which would be a surtax above $1 million of income. I think that is really going to, you know, catalyze a discussion about taxes.
Right. And that, if you remember, is earmarked, although earmarks are illegal nationally, it is earmarked for education and transportation.
Exactly. Wow. So many things left to discuss as the gubernatorial race gets underway. It'll be an interesting year to watch that. But we got a couple of minutes here. I do want to turn to this story, awful story, about abuse at the hands of Larry Nassar. He's the former physician for USA Gymnastics and Michigan State University. He was sentenced this week to up to 175 years in prison. Here's Michigan Judge Rosemary Aquilina on Wednesday.
It is my honor and privilege to sentence you because, sir, you do not deserve to walk outside of a prison ever again.
So more than 150 women gave victim impact statements in this 7-day sentencing hearing, including 2-time Olympian Allie Raceman.
Larry, you do realize now that we, this group of women you so heartlessly abused over such a long period of time, are now a force and you are nothing. The tables have turned, Larry. We are here. We have our voices and we are not going anywhere.
Renee, your reaction?
Well, there's so many things to say. I mean, I think that Larry Nassar is sort of ground zero for what is really a radiating scandal. There are several levels that I think we'll still be hearing about. You know, there's a lot of accounting yet to be done.
Yeah.
There are the institutions that knew about this and looked the other way, or dismissed or discouraged these women from coming forward. There's another level of institutions and other players who may not have known but didn't want to know. It's sort of a willful ignorance. There's a larger culture that, you know, until very recently dismissed and stigmatized victims. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, this is by certainly not the end of the story. This is really just the beginning of a radiating a scandal. I will say that a number of people have made parallels to the sexual abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. And I think the parallels are apt. You know, these are institutions that were more concerned about their own reputations than they were about protecting the children that were in their care. And, you know, it's just unspeakable.
You know, I've said it a couple times this week on the show, but it was a really eye-opening moment when Allie Raisman herself sat in the chair you're sitting at, and she alleged that USA Gymnastics was moving coaches around from gym to gym. Again, these are her allegations, you know, knowing that there were problems. So, like you said, this broader accounting is going to happen, hopefully going to happen. And some of it's actually happening right now at Michigan State University, where Larry Nassar was there for years. The athletic director, Mark Hollis, resigned today. So did the Michigan State University president, Luanna Simon. So, Tom, your thoughts?
So I agree with Renee. There is an issue of institutional culpability here. And it is interesting, particularly with the Olympics, an international organization, the degree to which we see this happening in different manifestations everywhere. I remind you about the Russian doping scandals, for example. There is something about this institution, the Olympics, that really reeks. And maybe this is going to become part of the expose or the transparency. Another point, the judge in this case got an enormous amount of criticism for the comments that you just played, particularly her words in honor and a privilege. There are many people who argue in a perverse fashion she's almost setting up an appeal because she does not appear to be as a judge should be, which is dispassionate. She's appearing very passionate in this. And judges themselves are not supposed to be on one side or the
advocates,
other. They're not supposed to be advocates. They really are supposed to be dispassionate.
So this is interesting because she was saying these things in the context of a sentencing hearing, not his actual criminal trial. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting to me. I mean, look, I'm not a legal scholar I'm just an observer from the outside. But, you know, I think when you have 150 women stand up and tell these stories, it's hard not to be affected by that somehow. And I was looking at her career, Judge Aquilino's career. I mean, she was the Michigan National Guard's first JAG lawyer. She was a JAG lawyer for 20 years. She got a commendation for her service in the first Iraq War. So you're shaking your head like,
remember,
what does it matter?
Okay, let's remember, judges in Michigan at least are elected. And this was partly a political speech. Hmm. And I think an inappropriate one.
Hmm. Renee, what do you think?
You know, I think that judges need to be impartial. I think that, you know, as much as I, approve of her opening up her courtroom to the women, to the victims, which I thought was wonderful and absolutely proportionate to the, you know, the situation here, I think her own personal statements, even at the sentencing level, sort of undermine the institution of, you know, judicial impartiality, which I think is something that's always under fire in states where judges are elected. And I don't think it's a good thing.
Okay,
overall.
So let me ask you. This has gone a place I didn't expect. But ultimately, do we judge her partiality or impartiality by her sentence, right? She gave him up to 175 years. I would say that I haven't heard anyone saying that that was an unfair sentence. She might have been a little dramatic in her presentation of it. But, you know, and in terms of her actual adjudicating of the sentence, no problem there.
So it does not appear to be, on the surface, an inappropriate sentence. But when you say it's an honor and a privilege, that's not what you're supposed to be saying.
On the other hand, she also read Larry Nassar's letter.
Which was appalling.
Which he said, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. Go ahead, Renee.
Well, I just think you can separate the two things. I mean, you can still be appalled at his behavior, supportive of the sentence and seeing him for the despicable character he is, especially when you hear this letter where he's just denying and, you know, blaming everybody else except himself, and still think that it's not a wise thing for a judge to be so blatantly partisan or, you know, sort of crossing the line into advocacy.
I agree with you about judges not being blatantly partisan. Mm. But I wonder if sometimes, you know, like Antonin Scalia got away with it for the entire time he was on the bench at the United States Supreme Court. So, you know.
I just think she may have handed a good lawyer an opportunity for an appeal.
Mm. Well, we'll see what happens. This was a very bracing part of this conversation, guys. So let's just turn quickly to our hubbubs because I want to end Friday on a high note. Tom, you're first.
Okay. There was this charming story in the Globe this week about a Boston resident, Matt Shearer, who is determined to find the best chocolate chip cookie in the region. He's already visited more than 130 places, and he posts about them to Instagram, complete with pictures and colorful commentary. All of that sounded great until we then learned that Mike has gained weight and on a recent visit to his dentist learned that he has 12 cavities and is now in need of a root canal. So here's the lesson I draw from Matt's quest for the best. Maybe the best would be to have no chocolate chip cookies at all.
Oh, okay. I'm going to just disagree with you there. Maybe just a few, fewer number of them. Renee?
I, too, have a food hubbub, but mine is a crisis, I have to report. According to the Boston Globe, also, there is a severe shortage of English cucumbers in Bellingham.
Shuck!
Yes.
Horror!
The Globe reports that Whole Foods, you know, the mega grocery that's now owned by the mega distribution company Amazon, recently rolled out a new inventory management system that had some kind of epic fail, leading to empty shelves and disgruntled customers. I myself had difficulty finding tofu at the Newton Whole Foods and at the Brookline Whole Foods. And what could be a more iconic Whole Foods item than tofu, I ask you? So luckily, the glitch has been worked out, and Whole Foods is back to normal. So now we can all just go back to complaining about the prices.
Quinoa, tortilla chips, kale.
My favorite.
Did I keep naming them all? Okay. So Whole Foods and Amazon supply chain fail. I like that one. Mine is, I'm going to first do a tip of the hat to WBZ, because this comes from a report from 1978 that they have reposted. And it's a terrific report about Beanpot fans in 1978 getting stuck at the Garden because of the blizzard of 1978. So let's play a little bit of that report.
I'm staying here all night. We have a car here. It's parked in the parking lot next door. We're going to go outside. We don't even know what it looks like outside yet. If we can't get home, we'll stay here and have a few beers till the bars close at 2, and then we'll come back in here and party.
I'm not going home tonight. Hopefully, I'll find someplace in town to stay.
At the Garden?
Not at the Garden. No way at the Garden. No way at the Garden.
There's so many reasons to love this report. I mean, people are talking about the authentic, awesome Boston accents. I loved the hair from 1978, but I think most importantly, these are true blue hockey fans, right? Who braved the blizzard of 1978 to see the Beanpot.
It's terrific to watch these clips on the internet because you can see how low-tech the weather report was. It's
exactly.
So much fun. You know, these sort of, you know, analog boards that they have to move around on wheels. It's great. Yeah.
And again, a hat tip to WBZ. They're running a special on Sunday on the 40th anniversary of the blizzard of 78. So, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor, it's always great to have you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston Magazine. Happy weekend to you.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Boston Public Schools and the United States Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, have both publicly denied sharing information about students. But there's renewed concern among immigration advocates that a Boston School Police report about an altercation between some students was shared with a database of local, state, and federal law enforcement, which ICE officials could access. Advocates say they fear the existence of, quote, a school-to-deportation pipeline in Boston. Joining me now with more is WBUR reporter Shannon Dooling. Hello, Shannon.
Hi, Magna.
Okay, so tell us exactly what's going on here. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice, this advocacy group, released a redacted school incident report from East Boston High School. What's going on?
Yeah, right. So, okay. The report documents an encounter in a school lunchroom at East Boston High School between a few different students. It's heavily redacted, but it says that a couple of students attempted to start a fight but were unsuccessful. The last line in the description of that incident in the report says, quote, "Officers will continue to monitor the incident. This incident will be sent to the brick."
Mm-hmm.
And so this is where the Lawyers Committee and other advocates are really raising concerns. The brick, as you know, is the Boston Regional Intelligence Center. Now, this data analysis center, really, at the Boston Police Department, it's accessible by state and federal law enforcement agencies, including federal immigration officials, ICE. And the idea behind BRIC is to keep tabs on gang threats, drug activity, potential terrorism activity. Matt Greger of the Lawyers Committee says he's concerned that something like this particular incident report would rise to the level of being reported to BRIC.
We've heard from BPS spokespersons that their school police won't share such records unless there are things like gang-related homicides or possible threats to public safety at stake. That clearly is not what happened when an unsuccessful fight was shared with the BRIC by Boston school police officers.
Okay, so this is what advocates are saying, but what do we know about what happened to this particular incident and or the students involved and whether it affected them or not?
Right. Okay, so I spoke with Sarah Sherman Stokes, who's an immigration attorney who represents one of the students mentioned in the school incident report. She says that her client is Salvadoran and came to the U.S. in 2014 at the age of 17. He was reunited with family in East Boston. He was applying for a special immigrant juvenile status. He got a visa. He actually had a pending green card application, and then he was arrested and detained by ICE. Sarah Sherman Stokes draws a line between that incident report and her client's arrest by ICE. She says in that report, he was labeled a gang associate. And she saw that incident report for the first time when it was presented to her by federal immigration officials in court. And so she concludes that once that report, the school incident report, hit BRIC, it's all of a sudden accessible by ICE. That gang associate label that, again, was applied by a school resource officer, all of a sudden has some serious consequences. Let's hear what she has to say about that.
And once he's labeled a gang member or a gang associate, that information gets replicated across databases. And it looks as though he's being identified as a gang member or a gang associate in multiple places. But it's all stemming from the same source, which is this Boston Public School incident report.
Okay. So, Shannon, but I'm curious about what law enforcement has to say about this. What did you reach out to Boston Police?
Yes, of course we did. And we spoke with Lieutenant Michael McCarthy, who told us that basically, when other law enforcement agencies share information with the Boston Police Department, they don't have, you know, control over what information is shared.
Right.
He said that if we have concerns or questions about how that Boston school police resource officer came to label someone as a gang associate, we should ask more about how, you know, school resource officers are trained. And so we've made that ask of Boston Public Schools. We're kind of waiting to hear back about specifics about how school resource officers are trained.
Okay. So just to clarify, he's saying that BRIC does its thing, but the real question is how are these school resource officers trained and what are they choosing to put in their reports?
That's exactly it. And so whether information goes directly to BRIC depends on the information that's in that report. And so certain things that are sent to BRIC, as we mentioned, they're gang-related incidents, drug-related incidents, terrorism-related incidents. Because that school resource officer had the tag of gang associate for this one student and said, you know, as we quoted from the report, this is going to be sent to BRIC, you know, it's logical to conclude that it was sent to BRIC and was then accessible by ICE. I should mention that Sarah Sherman Stokes' client is still detained by federal immigration officials. He's been detained for 15 months and he's facing deportation back to El Salvador. So this was an incident report that happened some time ago.
Okay, interesting. So that's WBUR's Shannon Dooling. She'll keep following the story and bring us more as it develops. Shannon, thanks so very much.
You're welcome.
So who's going to be the next CEO of Massachusetts Public Schools? Well, we're one step closer to finding out because the state's Board of Elementary and Secondary Education has been interviewing the three final candidates for Massachusetts Ed Commissioner. The candidates are Penny Schwinn, Angelica Infante-Green, and Jeffrey Riley. And the final vote takes place on Monday. WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin is at the Boston Omni Parker House where the interviews are taking place. Hello, Max.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so Jeffrey Riley, he's the one local guy amongst the finalists. His interview is taking place right now. You just stepped out. What's the board asking him?
Yeah, Riley's got kind of an unfair advantage since he's been the one reporting back to them about his receivership, his oversight of the Lawrence Public Schools. He's been asked about that very idea of receivership, basically state takeover of a struggling district. And, you know, he actually has some interesting thoughts about it. He says that when he came into Lawrence, it had a kind of stigma around it, that it was, a sort of foreign occupation of a school district. Here's what he said.
You know, when I came to Lawrence, people looked at me in some ways as like Darth Vader. And I had to kind of change that reputation that we are not here to blow everything up. We're here to work with you and support you.
So that's Jeffrey Riley. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Max. Yeah.
No, I the strategies that he talked about, I mean, approaching the union, really celebrating teaching, those were... It would be interesting to see him be commissioner because he would then be the person overseeing who goes into receivership, and hopefully it would be a kind of kinder, gentler version if he gets it.
Okay, interesting. So I want to actually spend a little time talking about the other two candidates, mostly because I suppose the Massachusetts education community does not know them as well since they're from out of state. First of all, Penny Schwinn, she is currently from Texas, even though she's been in a couple other places. She was the first to interview this morning. How did that go?
Yeah, it was interesting. She's certainly the most kind of controversial of the finalists. She had to field about half a dozen questions about a scandal that surfaced shortly after she arrived in Texas, where they had seen special education enrollments kind of plunge. And then the Houston Chronicle looked into it, and it felt as though they reported sort of an effective cap on the number of students who are allowed to take advantage of special education. That would have started well before Penny Schwinn came to Texas, but she became the point person. She sort of came out and said, there's no cap. It's an indicator, but then just 2 weeks ago, the U.S. Department of Education said, well, what you were doing, whatever it was not lawful. And so she has talked, and she sort of had to say, listen, we have to make this up to the kids who got left behind during that period. Here's a quote from her interview.
We have to absolutely determine who was not identified because of this indicator, who deserve to be identified, and provide compensatory services for all of those children. And if you think about that, it's 3% of the 500,000 students who are identified, but we're 3% of 5.3 million students year over year for 14 years. That's a lot of kids.
Hmm. So a significant amount of questioning, as you said, Max, was about the special ed controversy that she oversaw in Texas. So before we run out of time, though, I want to actually give you a chance to tell us about the candidate who followed Penny Schwinn, Angelica Infante-Green, a really different kind of interview than Penny Schwinn had.
Yeah, she kind of blew them away a little bit, it seemed like. I mean, she came in very assured. Now, her roots are in New York from a child, but then she worked for the New York City Department of Education and then the New York State, so she's no stranger to kind of intense media scrutiny and kind of intense spotlight quality. She's spent a lot of her career, she's a first-generation immigrant, she's spent a lot of her career focusing on English language learners, and she kind of pioneered a reform in New York which pivoted the state toward dual language learning, so mm-hmm. classes split into English immersion and Spanish immersion or Chinese immersion. That's been seen as a hugely promising thing. She actually practices it at home, speaking in Spanish to her children. Her husband speaks in English. And now Massachusetts embraced that change last year with the LOOK Act, and Angelica Infante-Green says you should see that as very exciting. There's a quote from her interview here as well.
You've had exponential growths of English language learners in different communities. That is such an opportunity, I have to tell you. Their home language is an asset that we have not capitalized on.
And I also noticed that during the conversation, she managed to get the board to just stop saying special ed and start saying differently abled. So it's interesting sort of the different feel that her conversation had. But, you know, as we said, the last interview is going on right now. Just in a couple of seconds, Max, here. What's next? When are we going to know who the new ed commissioner is?
Yeah, the turnaround happens really quickly. So they are going to adjourn, meet again on Monday, vote on a final candidate. They need a two-thirds vote, and then the Secretary of Education, Jim Pizer, makes the final decision. So Monday night, we should have a sense of who will be the captain of the ship of Massachusetts public schools.
Well, Max Larkin is Edify reporter for WBUR. Thank you so much for stepping out of the interviews. I'll get you right back to it, Max. Thanks so very much.
Thanks, Meghna.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Back in 2015, a Texas student opened a high school textbook and took a look at a map of the United States. And there was an interesting caption next to this map. The caption said, "The Atlantic slave trade between the 1500s and 1800s brought millions of workers from Africa to the southern United States to work on agricultural plantations." Wow. Well, that find and others like it in other Texas textbooks drew into sharp relief once again about the problematic ways students are taught American history when it comes to slavery and race. And with that in mind, Emerson College professor Jabari Asim set out to write a children's book that went beyond what's taught in classrooms. And the book is called A Child's Introduction to African American History, The Experiences, People, and Events That Shaped Our Country. And Jabari Asim joins us now in the studio. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Ah, thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So that caption from that Texas textbook, I mean, it seems almost extreme in its characterization of the institution of slavery. But was it things like that really that got you thinking we got to come up with a completely different way of talking about African American history in this country?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that was partly an influence, that kind of sugarcoating of history. But also, the book is, I have to say, is part of a trend, I think, that more people who are writing for children and young readers about this kind of thing, that we've begun to see some pretty candid descriptions of enslavement and Jim Crow and these eras. So it's, I think I'm inclined to see the book as part of a new trend.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So tell us how you approach it. I mean, how are you writing about this differently than what we've seen before?
Well, you know, it's a fine line. Working with my editor, the struggle was we really wanted to tell history as it actually happened. At the same time, we didn't want to so discourage young readers that they shut the book and ran away screaming, you know. So we did try to be honest and realistic, but we worked hard and hopefully succeeded in not being so harsh that people are left with a pessimistic view.
Well, I think you do a terrific job of that, actually. And I'd like you to read an example, if you could.
Oh, sure.
That really exemplifies this. And it's also one that's, you know, brings us right here to Boston.
Yes.
This is the story of Anthony Burns.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that?
Sure. You want me to read the passage?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Determined never to return to enslavement, more than 20,000 people fled to Canada over the next 20 years. Others took their chances and managed to avoid discovery. Some, like Anthony Burns, weren't so lucky. A year after escaping to Boston from Virginia, he was arrested on behalf of his owner. Before he could be transported back to the South, a large, angry mob formed to defend him. More than 2,000 whites and blacks stormed the federal courthouse where he was being held. They broke down the door and fought with deputies, who fired at least one shot into the crowd. The law prevailed, and Burns was placed in shackles and forced to walk to a ship waiting to take him back to Virginia. A year later, however, abolitionists succeeded in buying his freedom. He went on to study at Oberlin College and later moved to Canada, where he became a minister.
Yeah. So the story of Anthony Burns and the terrible fate that happened to him because of the Fugitive Slave Act, right?
Sure.
Sorry, I'm falling all over myself because it's funny. Like, we've talked about, on this show, we've talked about Anthony Burns several times. But the reason why I really like that passage is because once he gets taken back into slavery, lots of Bostonians protested that.
Yes.
you know, I have to say we'd never really talked about what happened after that.
Yes.
And it's sort of the leaving people hopeful part that you
sure.
get to in that paragraph, that he actually goes to Oberlin College after being freed and then becomes
right.
a minister. That part I hadn't heard.
Right. It's the long view of history that
yeah.
we're looking at here. And anytime we have an opportunity to show what happened beyond a particular pivotal incident, we did try to relay that information yeah. to readers.
But it's got to be hard to do it when you're talking about things like the Tuskegee experiment,
yes,
or the terrorism that was lynching
right.
in the South. I mean, how
right.
do you handle that for a book for kids?
Well, you know, I'm of two minds about it. For example, as a parent myself, I prefer not to have the sugar-coated version. I'd rather have my children have to deal with the harsh facts of history. We can discuss them together. We can contextualize them. At the same time, I am sensitive to parents who feel that some of that material may be too daunting for their children. So I don't think it's an either-or. I think it's important in the marketplace to have various treatments of this history so that parents can be comfortable making a choice that they can be at peace with.
Yeah. How did you go? I mean, like, so it's not the easiest thing in the world. Let me just put it this way. It's really hard to decide how to take all of African American history and, you know, how do you pick and choose what ended up in this book?
Well, the book is part of a series that the publisher had put together,
okay.
a child's introduction series. So there's a child's introduction to the night sky. There's a child's introduction to art history. So there was already a 96-page format in place. And I knew that the material that I came up with had to fit comfortably in that format, as well as leave room for illustrations. So I made a timeline starting from 1619 to the present.
Mm-hmm.
And I had too much material. I intentionally had too much material. I said that to the editor. I said, I'm going to bring you too much. Let's work together. You can help me reduce this to a manageable quantity.
Yeah. Everybody yeah. needs a good editor.
Oh, yeah. Especially me.
You also have this section about the busing crisis here
sure.
in Boston. Now, of course, this is something that Boston is still reckoning with, but there's been a lot of talk within the city about that. But your book is also for a national audience.
Yes.
Audience for kids across the country, I should
yes.
say. So, like, how'd you do that?
Well, it's less of a focus for me on Boston there, but more on the chronology,
yeah.
what was going on in the country at that particular point in time. So I try to place it in that context. It just happens to have a little more resonance, I think, here in Boston, quite naturally for Bostonians.
Okay. So I don't want to focus too much on sort of the more the crisis points of African-American
sure.
history, because you also, you know, feature accomplished African-Americans, politicians, civil rights leaders, prominent figures in pop culture. So many. I mean, there are great stories to be told as well.
Yeah. And I think the stories is the operative word there. You know, we wanted to expand the narrative in terms of African-American history. We didn't want it to be all negative, and we also didn't want it to be some kind of Pollyanna saga of accomplishment after accomplishment. You know, it's always sort of two steps forward, one step back, the nature of African-American progression, and we wanted to show that.
Yeah. So, Jabari, I have a question. I suppose I always have questions, but I'm sitting here listening to you, and I love this book, and I love the idea of it, but my mind is cycling back to that Texas textbook.
Sure.
Because, you know, on the one hand, whoever gets, whatever young person gets your book is a lucky kid, right? But there are far more children who are going to get these problematic textbooks, for example.
Yes.
So how do we change that? I mean, not to say that what you're doing
yeah.
here isn't important, but it feels like it's only a start in terms of really reshaping
I feel like
education.
That's a battle that has to be fought within education. It
yeah.
has to involve progressive educators. It has to involve parents. And it's easier in some respects for authors who aren't a part of that textbook struggle to just write our books, get them published, and offer them as alternatives. And I guess the stalwart soldiers in that struggle are librarians. I really owe everything to librarians because they work really hard to put this kind of narrative into the hands of readers who need it.
Yeah. Well, you've written, what, 8 other children's books?
This is my 9th children's book.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the one before this was Preaching to the Chickens, the story of a young John Lewis,
yes.
right?
Yes.
Okay. You like this genre, this medium.
Well, I'm a father of 5, so.
There's a lot of kids' books in your house,
yes,
I imagine.
Yes, yeah. So, you know, it kind of grew quite naturally out of the need to entertain and enlighten, I hope, my own children.
No, they are powerful. Mm-hmm. I've got 2 as well. And you can see when you read a really good kids' book to them about almost any subject, you can see that their understanding of the issue, the story, the person really does evolve. So to sort of get kids thinking about those things at a young age, I think it reaps amazing dividends later on.
Yeah, I think I can still remember many children's books that I read when I was very young and how they influenced me and shaped me. And I'm really grateful to have been fortunate enough to encounter them when I did. And I think I'm always thinking about that, too, in the back of my mind when I'm writing.
Yeah. Well, Jabari Asim is a professor at Emerson College and author of many books, as we've been talking about, including his latest, A Child's Introduction to African-American History, The Experiences, People, and Events That Shaped Our Country. It's illustrated, we should, by the way, have a tip of the hat to Lynn Gaines.
Yes,
beautifully
indeed.
Illustrated.
Yes.
And Jabari is also former editor of The Crisis, the magazine of the NAACP. It's always great to have you. Thank you so very much for coming in.
Thanks, Megan. It was great.
Well, Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, woo, Allison Bruzek. And we also had help today from Cassandra Sunt, Zoe Mitchell, Lily Tyson, and Anna Saldinger. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. This is Radio Boston.